One of the things I think about a lot is anxiety. Why does a person get overwhelmed, have a panic attack, and they're not present when they talk to people? What actually causes that? And I believe it's the distance between who you are and the character you play, the emotional gap between how you're feeling in the moment and how you're acting, or it's having too many choices and not knowing where to go. So this is an in-depth chat where we unpack anxiety, loyalty, if we have free will. So just simple, easy to understand question that I'm sure you'll enjoy. You're in a desert and you have to choose between two doors. One has all the money and all the status in the world. And then the other one has, you're poor, but you have the most beautiful relationships. Which door do you pick?
Whoa. I'd probably say the poor but relationships, I'd say.
Huh. Why?
Oh, I knew that question was going to come. no, I think a lot, not more is that, you know, all the money and all the wealth and all the hype, I suppose, can provide you with some things. But if you haven't got some of the quality stuff behind it to be able to share it with, you know, share that wealth with others and not having that relationship, is it's probably a little bit more meaningful in the longer term rather than just the monetary side of things.
It's tricky, that balance of money doesn't make you happy, but everyone that tells you that has money. What's your take on that statement that money doesn't make you happy?
Yeah, I don't think it makes you happy. I think it can make things in life easier with just easing pressures around, you know, general cost of living and be able to get stuff that you want to get and the likes from there. But I think for majority of people, and you know, you do hear vast stories of people that do have a lot and are able to intermingle with their communities and those in their same circles. But then you hear some really cool stories from other people where, you know, if you look from a success perspective of what they're doing with money, probably isn't there, but they get the value through the relationships and stuff that they hold close to them, because it's that's what gives them the value.
It's interesting, it's like, of all the investments you could make, the investment into a meaningful relationship probably has the highest return on investment. And yet how little time people actually invest in it. What's, I guess, been your lessons in terms of understanding people in the finance world and the complications with love and money?
Yeah, I think one of the big things which I definitely look at is, yeah, patience is probably one of the biggest things of, you know, patience and the trust relationships that you can build up with people. That's absolutely paramount to any ongoing relationships that you've got. And I think there's, you know, probably the past 10 years or so, there had been chat within the business world, the likes of moving from, you know, we've got relationships to we've got partnerships between each other and the likes in there, which sounds cool. But you've also got to make sure that that's actually true to what those partnerships actually are. So, you know, a bit like, you know, working within sales and having, you know, your business development manager or someone that works for you, that's your best pal and buddy, if once you're sort of providing them with work and helping things tick over. And that, you know, that's a really good relationship, but where I think it transitions over that partnership side is, you know, are they someone that you still interact with outside of the business world? You know, do they call you in at the weekends and get involved with your interests, or do you get involved with interests between each other? And that's where I think it really does start turning over to more of a partnership side. And regardless of, you know, how much moves with technology and all those sort of things in this fast-paced world, people do still really value that. And I think from the finance perspective, with whatever you're dealing with finance, and that ability for you to be able to be that trusted person people come to simply giving your honest input, opinion, recommendation, whatever it is that they're looking for, that they can rely on those words that you say. Because I think, you know, I'm a big believer of, you know, sticking to what you say and keeping to it. And I think a lot of people mentioned that to me through my business career and lifestyle, is that or lifetime, I should say, is, you know, the ability of being loyal to what you say and what you do is really key.
Would you go on a partnership with a person that cheats on their wife? Like, is loyalty that important? Like, let's say, for example, their business. Yeah, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think it's like with anything. Going into that partnership, knowing how they operate, probably not. If it's something where, you know, you start learning more about that person as that partnership starts to develop, that's, you know, when questions do start being asked. But it's, you know, going and having all that knowledge, because I think it does start to speak to a character of, you know, it's not just a relationship that they're potentially going to be cheating on, right? There's going to be other things that are going to be potentially red flags that are going to pop up along the way, that could make your business relationship and your business partnership really, really challenging.
And just, it's interesting you brought up loyalty, because I find the values I hold dearest to my heart are the things that I'm capable of doing and also the things I'm most reactive to. So, for example, mine is empathy is a core value. So when I'm cruel, I can be very cruel, but I also care deeply about people. And if someone's cruel too, I get reactive. Or responsibility. If I play victim a lot, oh, poor me. And as soon as I see someone play victim, I'm like, oh, for fuck, get over yourself. So what's your take on why you held the value of loyalty in such high esteem?
Yeah, it's interesting. If I look back to one of my previous careers that I had, which was in sort of debt management space, you know, I came from that, you know, started at the bottom, rose to the top, and, you know, held, I think, within 15 years, different positions, both in New Zealand and Australia, you know, different seniorities and the likes from there. And I think, you know, that's where I kind of felt, you know, that loyalty would pay off until, you know, within the space of 2 weeks, I received my redundancy notice and see you later and you're at the door. Which you kind of, you know, in one way, hit quite hard to sort of think, well, you know, that whole loyalty thing that I stick by was, well, is it actually worth it? With that, this is how you get treated. But going through and looking from two aspects of it is, number one, yes, there's that personal attachment that I've got to the role and what I've done and the people I've worked with and the likes from there is one thing. But then having the ability to flip it actually on a business head and saying, if I was new to a company looking at, you know, the structure that was there and the likes from there, would I have made the same business decision? And I probably would have said yes. But I still think the part that I look past that now of from a loyalty perspective is, you know, a lot of those people that I worked with in that company, most of them, you know, well, still some of them I've got some really good relationships with. And we're now talking some, what, 20 odd years plus, is that those relationships have continued, which is really, really good. So if you're thinking about the couple of other jumps that I've done within my finance world as well, I've seen them come on board with me now as a financial advisor, that they're more than happy for me to support me within the new role that I'm doing. But, you know, and at the end of the day, I'm looking after the most important thing, which is their, you know, future financial wealth, or, you know, future financial protection should something go wrong. So while that loyalty flag may not be there so much from the corporate and the corporation side of things, those relationships that I've built with inside the company have, I suppose, in a way, they've paid dividends from that, because they know they know who I am, and they know how I operate, regardless of, you know, the situations that sometimes get put in.
Yeah, corporate's fascinating. I got a trial at McDonald's, and I failed. They didn't want me because I like their system. I forgot what they told me to do, so I tried to wing it and try to make a different system. Which obviously that's arrogant, and their system's better. But I got free food and they kicked me out. But I always wonder, like as for example, what I would think of business owners before I started business has changed. You know, I'm more empathetic to, you know, the challenges they face and they're trying their best. Corporate, I haven't got to that level yet. What do you think comes unstuck or why corporate appears to lose its humanity?
I think it just really comes down to the bare bones of it. And there's, you know, if you look at the reason, for example, that, you know, a board's put in place and the like, there is that they are ultimately there to look after the shareholders. So the ones that are providing the finances into the company, that's what a board and, you know, senior management are there to do, from a very traditional perspective. So, you know, that's removing all the personality, a lot of that loyalty per se, and just saying, well, shareholders are investing us to make money. And in a way, we will continue to make money regardless of what we do. And it's quite interesting, I think, with how that spins around, especially from, I think, you know, Richard Branson's probably one of the big ones where he sort of tried to turn that around of saying, you know, if you look after your, if you've got happy employees, that they will then look after the clients, which ultimately then looks after the shareholders. So a different take on that. I suppose in a way you naturally look at it from a corporate perspective. If times are tough, and of which, you know, we're starting to see some of that now within the New Zealand business economy, generally the largest expense any business carries is their staff. So you sort of look at around about a third, a third of your costs are employment related. So it can be a very easy target of saying, well, if revenue isn't growing, then let's focus on where the largest cost comes, which is from staff, and that's where your redundancies come from.
Kind of wild. It's like, it's almost as though that's a lack of tracking and understanding. Like, one, to hire someone that, you know, is not contributing to the bottom line in some way. Because, like, if you clearly determine, for example, say, administration, like, sales is easy. You give them a percentage of the sale they get. But administration, you might have worked out over a year. If the administration replies to an email within 5 minutes, the lifetime value of the client is 18 months when normally it's 12 months. And then you can incentivize them based on their ability to execute on that deliverable that you understand. So on the outside, you see, oh, here's old Greg making, you know, 90 grand a year. Got to cut him. He's not contributing to the bottom line. He's not in sales. And then the delay of the impact of that isn't really clear until, you know, that 12 months has been reached. So what would you do differently if you were like Jeff Bezos and you owned this massive corporation of a million employees? Would you keep the humanity? How would you make loyalty?
Wow, it's a really difficult question because, as I say, you still got those interests of the shareholders that you're trying to keep there. But I think a lot of it is through transparency and through communication as well. And I think people do really understand that sometimes there are some really tough decisions that do need to be made. But in part of that, I think that especially through the consultation process and what you do through that, in a way, while you still might end up at that same decision, as long as you are talking with everyone about what's going on, being truly transparent and, you know, not just talking about, we're just going to share with you what we want you to see. It's looking at, you know, all cards on the table. And, you know, then also making sure that people understand that other sacrifices that are being made throughout the business as well. So, you know, little things of, you know, if something in business is really in a tough time, then it's the entire, I suppose the entire hierarchy or the entire ecosystem that's got to be seen to be looked at. So, you know, that's from your CEOs to, you know, down to your senior management, to your middle management, to your, you know, what your frontline staff and also those back office staff that help you that say, well, yes, we're looking at potentially redundancies here, but we are also looking at redundancies elsewhere. And, you know, potentially pay, you know, pay freezes or pay decreases or whatever the case is, so that people can kind of say, well, it's not just us in the bulk of where that cost is coming from, that's taking the pain from it. Because I think there's so many stories that you see where, you know, there's corporates that are going through redundancies, and most of the time, you know, it is the frontline workers that are being hit. But then you still see that board members are increasing their directors' fees, and that you see CEOs receiving extremely large cash bonuses, which, you know, as an employee, you get people looking at going, well, hold on, if there's a $200,000 or $300,000 cash bonus that's going in, that's three or four of our workers that you've just thrown out in the street just so you've got that. So that's what I was saying, is that, you know, the pain's got to kind of really been to be shared across the board. And as I say, at the end of the day, yes, there's still got to be hard decisions to be made, but I think it does kind of help that if people see that you are being transparent through that entire process.
So it's interesting. It's like, on one hand, I'm torn between should the success be shared? You know, so I think a person, a staff member should be fairly remunerated for the contribution they're making to the business. Is it okay for, say, the CEO to make 17 million, but they're making 100 grand, but the business is going great? And if they try to get a job somewhere else, they'd get 80 grand. Like, is that immoral? What do you think? I don't actually know.
I think, you know, it depends if, yeah, A, how big the companies are and the lots of that. You know, so you look at Amazon, from what she mentioned before, with Jeff Bezos versus somebody that's, you know, working inside an Amazon warehouse. You know, the differences within those pays are going to be massive, right? And I'm also a really strong believer is, you know, especially that top end, is that there's only, well, from my belief, there's only so much money that you can actually make, right? Because there's only so much that you can spend unless you're looking at weird and wonderful things and how you create things to be able to spend the money that you earn. But you do hear, you know, from some of the other ones, from, you know, the philanthropists and whatnot that are around, where, you know, you look at Gates and the likes of what he's doing or what has done with putting back into other areas with foundations and the likes from there. It can be a way of looking to try and generate that wealth elsewhere, or should I say distribute that wealth elsewhere.
So you reckon cap it? So if you're earning over a mil, what's the point? You've got everything. Give it to your staff.
Yeah, why not? As you know, do you really need 200 million? Because most of the times that, you know, the guys that are in those types of roles, it's not just going to be, you know, their salary with what they're driving from the business that they're making on it. They're going to be making it from their 20 investment properties that they've got, their other side gigs that they've got running, you know, the investments that they're making within the financial world, potentially off their own stocks as well as others. So, yeah, it's not just all about the money that's coming through the company. There's, because, you know, you genuinely, as you learn how to make money, you do learn how to make it in a whole lot of different areas so that you can diversify where your income's coming from, rather than just having that one source. Like myself, of, you know, thinking of going through a period or from that redundancy perspective is just having that one income from where I was at, and that disappearing pretty much overnight.
Yeah, it's wild. What's your take on these greedy landlords, profits gouging, getting the tax cuts now? What's your take on landlords, and do they deserve the hate?
Do they deserve the hate? It's a massive catch 22, I think, and it's not so much sort of sitting on the fence, but you can definitely see, you know, from both sides here is that, you know, yes, they are propping up, you know, with having the interest deductibility coming back in, but, you know, they're making money through the capital that they're building within the side of the property. And then some would also argue that they're taking effect of, because of the pressure on the rental property market at the moment, that they're just increasing stuff to continue to make money. And then on the flip side of things, you know, the New Zealand housing market would be in a massive, well, I suppose it'd be much worse off if we didn't have those investors that were in the market as well, being able to provide those houses for people that can't get into the market themselves. So I sit here as a not even a property owner, let alone an investor. It's hard to see of where it works, but you know, if you're looking at some of the ways to tackle a problem, is I suppose the thought with the change in policy is that if we can give something back to those landlords, then it potentially means that they can invest elsewhere, which hopefully eases the burden of the rental market. To whether or not that happens, of course, true is going to be seen to be in the coming years that it works through. Yeah, so it's a tough one, I think. To say of what's right and wrong.
I mean, if you've got a lineup of people willing to buy what you're selling, you're going to charge more. Like, and then if your cost to deliver that service is higher than you, so maybe interest deductibility will decrease it. But fundamentally, if you can charge more, you will. Like, if I could, I would charge as much as I'm allowed, as much as they still see value in. Like, you know what I mean? Like, whether it's rental property or business.
Yeah, you know, exactly. And I think, you know, looking at it from another aspect is, you know, I still remember when I bought my first iPhone, which I think was the iPhone 4 that I bought then. And I think at that time, you know, it was it's still really expensive for a mobile phone. And I think it was close to around about $800 or $900 that you're spending on a phone. And now you look at the same phone, pretty much, especially for Apple users, and you know, yes, I'm in that Apple ecosystem, is, you know, you're now spending for essentially an upgrade on the phone, $2,500 for pretty much the same phone that's got the same apps that you like that does the same thing. And it's because, you know, as you say, the demand drives, or supply drives that demand. And if you got people that are going to spend $2,500, then why not charge $2,500?
It's wild, eh? It costs them $10 to make. So you think, isn't it crazy? So the value is a perception, not a reality. So from a feature standpoint, there's some beautiful things about it. But in terms of a differentiation from other features available and other products that are more affordable, it's all just been instilled. It's all just been built in the eyes. So what are you actually buying? Status? What do you think you buy when you pay $2,000 for $10?
I think status is a part of it, because I think, you know, you do talk to a number of you know, Apple users when they see that they've got the phone, and the question is, like, you know, what version are you running? Or they can see, you know, what shape it is. Is it the squarer shape for the newer one, or is it the rounded one, which knows it's an older one? And I remember having a joke with a very, very close friend of mine, and probably more so best friend, and probably close to the family. He had a work phone, which I think was the 6. It literally kept on looking at every time, thinking that should be in a bloody museum. For what
loser.
It was. And but you know, if you look at, you know, from an Apple provider perspective, the one of the main things, you know, from my opinion, that reason that people like the Apple device of the phone, the iPad, the Mac, whatever it is even with those upgrades you do, you can sync it, and regardless of that upgrade, you turn it on, and it's exactly the same phone, look, touch. You don't need to use a new system. You don't need to update a whole lot of stuff. It's essentially the same phone. With maybe a slightly better camera. It does some cool stuff. That's a little bit better than the last version. And you know, as I said, it's either got rounded edges or it's the more square ones.
Quite interesting, because I was watching a guy talk about brand is just changing people's behavior at scale. So teaching. So what Apple's taught you is when you do this thing, you get this outcome. So when you buy an Apple product, you experience the thing you thought. And then the concept of homeostasis is the same with chemistry and I think in social settings too, where basically if there's a change to the equilibrium, so if there's a new thing, it will try to get back to the equilibrium. So you've got this consistency of behavior to consuming Apple products. And when you try and use a different one, all the change and fear and resistance to that thing fights it. So provided they continue to deliver on your expectation, as well as the status, perceived status. So like if Apple had like a fallout, like Elon Musk or whatever, and people, oh my God, you've got an Elon Musk product? You must, I don't know. What do they hate him for? I still don't get it. What's your take on Elon Musk? Is he a good guy?
I just think he's just so different to other people. I think that's the thing that scares everyone, is, you know, everything from his views of the world to what the future looks like, to what he's doing, to challenging natural, traditional thinking. It's just, some of the stuff is just so far, left or right, depending of which side he's on, that people just like, is this guy serious? With where he's going. And I think, it's just really polarizing, I think, to a lot of people. So, there's one thing in life, business, or, just in general, change is always scary for, the normal human. When you're saying, to go, we are looking at change, but that change is going to be, you are going to be moving from, it's not just from white to black, it's from white to some other color that hasn't even been described, and do you actually call it a color? It's just, that's the part that I think, as I say, just polarizes people.
It's interesting how much of your choices have already been made in the sense of conditioning. You had this stimulus, you react this way. How much of life do you think is predestined by our programming, and do we have free will?
Oh, geez, that's a big question. I think in a way there's definitely parts. I would say, from the predestined is based on, how your upbringing's been, what circles you're involved in, and the likes of that. I think, that's where some of that predestiny can help to predict of what life, future life looks like. Is there truly free will? I think mostly yes. And it's one of the big things I challenge people on a number of times. And it was actually through, I think Stephen Covey, through one of his books that I listened to. And the big thing he talks about in life is choice. So there's so much choice that we have in life. And yes, we either, we celebrate it, or we commiserate in it, or we hate it, and the likes from there. But there can be some really hard truths for everyone to answer sometimes of, you've ended in this position because of choices that you've made. And as long, you've got to understand that those choices have led you down the path. So kind of a bit like the butterfly effect, right? But it's really hard to look internally and accept those choices. So, staying with an employer that you absolutely hate, or within, and don't get me wrong, sometimes there is a lot of stuff when you start talking about relationships and watching there is different things that can contribute to that, where, is it your choice? Can be hard sometimes with them. But ultimately, there have probably been some of those smaller choices that you've made to stay in go or watch from there. And I think it was where Stephen Covey had said, I think it was him, he was in the seminar, and there was a person for the audience that came up to me afterwards and pretty much had said to him, well, look, you're telling me it's my choice that I've decided to stay with this employer that I hate, with clients or customers that we serve that disrespect us and all this stuff. And he just turned around and said, ultimately, yes, it is. Because you haven't made that decision to say, I've had enough of this and I'm going to look elsewhere to make life happier.
It's interesting.
I know it's hard, but...
Yeah, tell him, get fucked, you wusses. So... I'll summarize. Interesting. Yeah. People say they pursue happiness, but I think what they're really pursuing is familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
They're seeking what they know. So like the story of the dog, I think Tony Robbins said, it's like every morning he would go to the same spot and he'd sit on his favorite little like seat, perfect amount of sun, wind. And then one day there was a nail, but he still chose to sit there, but he would complain and howl and complain, but he just stayed there because that was his spot, until the point where it was so painful he couldn't handle it anymore, so he left, he moved. And I think that's quite interesting, is that no matter how painful the relationship, the business, the situation, it's less painful than changing. So it's the thing you choose to do because that's all you've done.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we change? How do we make better choices? What's your...
How do you make better choices? I think sometimes it's just some of the basic stuff is, you know, what am I enjoying by staying? What am I missing? Or, you know, what am I potentially missing from going? But a lot of people sort of look at it to say, well, a lot of that stuff can be, well, not so much, it's just the grass is always green and what I'm going to gain. It's also looking and saying, well, what am I gaining back from deciding to leave that employer that I hate? So, you know, getting back the feeling that you've got control in your life, so that you've got control in your decisions, to the fact that you're not miserable every night and unloading on your partner and your family and your kids every time that you get home each night, which is putting pressure on, you know, on relationships and the likes from there. So it's not just about what are you going to gain from the new opportunity that could come up. It's also what are you just gaining within the near distance. To make life happy. But it's probably just coming back to that, what you mentioned before is, you know, the pursuit of happiness, but again comes back to what you were mentioning about the money side. What is happiness? And so, you know, what makes people happy? I mean, yeah, if I won the lotto tomorrow and, you know, I got $10 million, sure, it's going to make me happy for a period of time. But what does that happiness actually look like going past that initial cash injection, I suppose, from that lotto win?
Yeah, Jordan Peterson says happiness is having a goal that you're going towards. But I think I sort of see happiness as a comparison. Happiness is a step up from a prior state. So in actual fact, if you want to pursue happiness, you need to pursue suffering so you know what happiness is. Because happiness is an improvement on how you're feeling. Contentment's different. Life sucks, but I'm okay with it. What do you think? What's a better way to live than happiness? What are you pursuing?
Yeah, I think it's always trying to be better. I think there was constantly learning is probably the big thing for me. And I never... And my wife will say this is that, you know, I sit down and I love cooking, really, really enjoy cooking when I get the opportunity to. But yet I don't think there's ever been a meal that I've cooked that I've been 100% happy with. There's always something that I will find in that meal that I've cooked that I could have done better. And of course, my wife says to me, I said, you just are never happy and you're constantly looking at the negative side. But I kind of challenge it a little bit of saying, well, I know it's just saying of that seek for perfection, I suppose, from what you've got. And it's always probably come from that ingrained thing that I've got is always just trying to improve, even if it's by that 1% or a 0.5% of just get that slightly a bit better. So, you know, yes, that steak's come out absolutely perfectly cooked, but the seasoning isn't quite right. So, you know, how do you change that around? So that's probably the big thing which I always look at. And so I've always been a big one is even from a process perspective, I get things into a process, which I'm normally about 95% there. But then I'll, again, go back on that process and go, right, from there, how do I improve on that? And not, you know, not completely changing the entire thing, but just how to constantly improve on things by the small amounts. Yes, it can be some big stuff that you get, but a lot of the time it's just that's possible. So I'm never satisfied in status quo.
Interesting. What, just to explore that a little bit, who was the hardest person to impress growing up?
The hardest person to impress, I think there's been, you know, parts of my life from a number of people. I think I've had bosses that I've always tried to impress, partners that I've tried to impress, parents that I've tried to impress from that, and it's just to look to try and get that satisfaction. But even when I did get it, it still was never enough.
Mm.
It was like, okay, I know that you've given me the praise and you know, you're happy with that, but I'm not happy with it. So, again, looking to improve. So some say it's a flaw that, you know, just kind of got to be happy of, you know, 95% is okay most of the time.
It's passed, just
yeah. So, but yeah, I think there's always been different aspects, and I think, you know, just little things with each of those people. There hasn't really been, I think, in my life, anyone which has really stuck out to say, you know, I've got to make them absolutely happy. I think there's been different elements within all of those relationships. Where I suppose it's just been trying to improve on.
It's just interesting, like loyalty and the constant need to improve, and it's not good enough. You also often, like, people's identities stem from the behavior that's modeled to them when they're growing up and defining their identity, as well as the feedback they're receiving. So I could imagine a child that would try really hard for the affection of their parents and the validation, and the parents aren't trying to be mean or anything, they're just not very forthcoming with praise. So in order to fit within that environment, they keep aspiring to be better to earn that. And then also with loyalty, there's a certain level of security that comes from knowing this person is loyal, and why it might be something you value so much, because there's people that you can't rely on. That's partly why I thought I would explore it, but it might not be that.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, I think there's probably some truth within that, and, you know, sort of thinking back to, you know, early childhood and the likes, you know, do come from a household where parents separated at a very early age, and, you know, trying to learn the different dynamics of what the relationship with mum looks like versus what the relationship with dad looks like. And I definitely have gone through and, you know, tried to work that out, because obviously those relationships, albeit through a general, I suppose, traditional upbringing of having mum and dad there, where they're kind of playing off each other. And, you know, as you do, there's good parts in that, but that's what makes the relationship nice and cohesive, or what's believed to be cohesive. But then having them on their signature ways of just trying to say, well, hold on, mum likes it this way, but dad likes it this way, and, you know, how do you sort of then change change the tempo to try and match that, to get some sort of harmony in between. And don't get me wrong, I think there was definitely times that I probably challenged that with both of them over a number of years, especially through my mid high school years, to probably too much of an extent that they weren't comfortable with. But yeah, as I say, that's possibly part of it as well, was that thought of going, well, that confusion of the challenge of going, well, is this good enough here? If it's not, you know, do I change it around? Which then that sometimes they couldn't cope. So, you know, definitely apologize to mum and dad for some stuff that I put them through. But they call it character building.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's good. They're building resilience. It's interesting. It's like,
yeah,
if you're always having to make adjustments for others, it's hard to know who you really are. And then it's also, if you tie that into, I'm always trying to be better, then when am I enough? So when do you think you would be enough?
Yeah, it's I relate this back. So I went on a leadership course with a previous employee back in, would have been mid-2000s or so, and it was the first time it sort of tackled, you know, the whole Myers-Briggs personality profiling and the likes from there. And the one that I came out with was, ENTJ, I think it was. So looking to be somebody that's out there, not so much too much of the judgmental, but a lot of it was around people and things like that. But anyway, long story short, there was a really in-depth piece that they came exploring of what that profile looked like to me. And it was about 16 pages. So it was really, really in-depth. And one of the big things that stuck out to me, which was concerning but also promising, I felt, was so people with my characteristics can sometimes become something to what the eye of the beholder wishes them to see. So I kind of looked at it and thought, does that mean that I just manipulate myself around to get the advantage of the best of people? So that's one angle that you can kind of look at it at. But the other one was also looking at, it's just around that adaptability of being able to, you know, is it someone that needs a bit of direction? Is it someone that needs a bit of compassion? Is it someone that, you know, needs a bit of honesty, and how that works in with relationships? So that's where I think, you know, that constant learning and adapting is something which has come from, is it's just part of me. To when it gets to a stage of when's enough for me?
When are you enough?
That's
not
a
what you're
really
doing.
Good question. And to be, when am I enough? I'm yet to find that, and even yet to probably ask myself that question. To be completely honest, because I'm still not at that stage of my happiness that I'm happy with what I am doing, what I'm producing, and what I'm contributing to in life. So I hope to get there at some stage with where I feel I am enough.
Yeah, you can let 82 send in a note to the podcast. Like, I'm happy now, guys. Cracked it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
There's something I've been exploring lately. So I'm pretty similar in the, like, I guess the pro of it is you get to understand intimately what other people need from you, which is a very valuable skill. The thing I realized the cost of it for me was anxiety, because there was so much distance between how I feel and how I'm acting. That dance between those two things meant that I felt anxious. But when I've met someone that I didn't have that up and I was emotionally authentic, I could say anything, be emotionally authentic. I was still, I was calm. What has your experience been with either anxiety, or what do you think has been helpful in navigating those challenging, high-stakes sort of encounters with people?
Yeah, I suppose a couple of things come to mind there. So one was my first real experience with anxiety as a whole, which was actually just at the start of at COVID, probably with similar people. But there was a few things that were going through. So kind of paint a picture is that, you know, obviously during COVID, we were locked down and needing to learn to live with inside our four walls and whatnot. So I decided that I'd take up reading, which is something that I hadn't done in years. And more so, no, not reading business books and all those sort of things for me. It was more, you know, sort of leisurely reading. But it was at a time I, you know, had done a little bit of reading, went to get up off the bed and felt like I was about to pass out. And I had a few other things over that coming week to so with, you know, heart palpitations and things like that. Which scared the absolute bejesus out of me, thinking, you know, because of course you catastrophize anything and oh, it's a heart attack and, you know, I'm about to drop dead. But it was really interesting going in and talking to a GP about it. And he sort of just looked at me and just nodded and he said, "You've just gone through and experienced your first panic attack." Thinking, "No, I haven't." And he said, "Well, just tell me with what is going on in your life at the moment." And I thought, "I know, yeah, everything's fine." And it's something, you know, I didn't think it was anything more so that I'd anything more than what I'd coped with before. But he'd said, "Right, just list it out." So I was like, "Well, we're going through COVID." Obviously, everyone didn't know, really know what was going on. I just found out that I'd been made redundant from a second job after relocating from Auckland to Marlborough. So didn't know what that looked like. My wife had resigned for a job in February. But didn't quite know with what was happening there. We had a house on the market, worried about what transition was with the staff and stuff that we were working through. And he sort of just looked at me and it's like, that would break a lot of people, let alone saying everything's okay. So that was probably my first, as I said, first experience with anxiety was with what I'd had. But I suppose on the flip side of that is I generally felt we had a few, yeah, I wouldn't say absolutely disasters that occurred, but you kind of think about the situations where it's really high stress environments within a working environment. So, you know, little things like, you know, obviously trying to manage through natural disasters and our response to that from a business perspective, even though, you know, at the time during the Christchurch earthquakes, we weren't a part of it, but we had a number of our clients and our customers and everything that were working through that. With what that looked like, how that panned out for what were the months and years to come, with how did we work around that with our business partners. Things about, you know, major business interruptions, events that we're working through, is I generally tended to be quite calm within those environments. But again, in the background, probably similar to what you're saying, on the face of it, very calm and working well to those events, but in the background, probably not really understanding of how much it was actually taking out of me from my personal well-being. So it's probably in the past couple of years, it's been more so just learning and understanding and appreciating and identifying, you know, when those times do come around, to just be able to take a little bit of a back step.
It's interesting. It's often the people that give the least that can handle the most. So you think how little emotion you either invest into a relationship and a partnership, into a business, and how much you feel that vulnerability, the more resilient I find that person is. Problem is there's a cost because it's like sweeping out of the rug. But you often see that. You see humans, like if you've ever seen someone with a very monotone consistency, their body language is quite the same, they're not overly emotive, and they have sort of like a nihilistic view. They're not that big in investing in people. Often they've been conditioned to emulate a person that doesn't invoke a reaction from someone else. So they've taken in the chaos of their life and the struggles that they've faced. And in order to get through that, they need to invest very little. So I just, those sort of people, if you ever come across them, get, you know, they're like Winston Churchill sort of vibes. Break when war happens. But anyways, we've done a whole last podcast, mate. So I appreciate you coming on, and thank you for opening up your soul to the world.
And a pleasure.
Glad we don't have free will. That's good.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. It's been enjoyable.